Magna Carta, the Great Charter. Why is it so great, and why are we even talking about it? Well, if you've been listening to this show, you already know why. It's because it's 800 years old this year, and because even if it weren't 800 years old, it's pretty darn important. The Magna Carta is the first of a number of documents which comprise the British Constitution, and guess what? The British Constitution has a continuation in the American Constitution, and A.E. Dick Howard, one of the great experts in the world on this subject, is here to talk to us about it. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. It's part two of our two-part episode on Magna Carta.
Your weekly constitutional is hosted by Professor of Law Stuart Harris and underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
If you're just joining us, or if you just picked this podcast or this episode out of the blue, then you've come in on part two of a two-part episode on the Magna Carta, the Great Charter, featuring an interview with a remarkable fellow, A.E. Dick Howard of the University of Virginia, who's one of the world's leading experts on the subject and a really, really nice and funny and entertaining fellow. If you really want to get into the nitty-gritty of what we talked about last week, you'll have to go online, you'll have to listen to part one, but here's the brief summary. Basically, Magna Carta is one of the foundational documents of both the British and American Constitution. Many, many important concepts came out of Magna Carta, notably things like due process of law. And one of those that's often overlooked is that Magna Carta guaranteed, and was later, this guarantee was imported into a number of the charters that made their way across the Atlantic and founded the various colonies and ultimately the states in the United States, guaranteed something called the rights of Englishmen. The idea that simply by leaving England, our forebears, the people who made up the British North American colonies, did not give up their rights of Englishmen. Now, if that sounds familiar, that denial or that perceived denial of those rights was one of the causes of all those troubles back there in the 1760s and the 1770s. Let's go and talk some more to A.E. Dick Howard.
Now, that was the early 17th century, at about the same time where Cook is quarreling with the king, defending parliamentary rights. The English are putting in place important statutes like the Petition of Right, the English Bill of Rights. And, of course, that was part of this transatlantic conversation. Needless to say, as institutions began to grow in this country, we began to have courts and lawsuits and legislation and all the rest. It was natural that they would incorporate English law. The first law books, you look at the inventory of a typical 17th century library, a private library, people like William Byrd down at Westover, it always had Cook. Mm-hmm. It had Cook's commentaries on Magna Carta, Cook's law reports. It would include cases like Dr. Bonham's case. And so the ideas that were planted in the charters were being reinforced one generation after another. Of course, this was a different. This was the other side of the Atlantic, and American ideas were beginning to mix in. We were domesticating these ideas. But one part of the story is that the charters provided that when colonial legislatures adopted ordinances, they were supposed to be sent back over to England to be approved to make sure they were consistent with English law. And what I found interesting there is that even as early as the 17th century, the idea is being planted of an external standard by which you judge whether a law is valid or not. But what we today would call the supremacy clause of the federal constitution is in an interesting way anticipated by the notion that the Virginia House of Burgesses agrees to a bill. In theory, at least, it's supposed to be sent over to the Privy Council or some other body in London to be approved. Now, in those days, it probably took 6 weeks or 8 weeks to get the thing over and back. Maybe you moved on. Maybe in a practical sense, there wasn't immediate review as it would be today. But still, the idea is you look at something which calls itself a law, there's an external standard by which you measure it. That's a very interesting idea. Some cases in colonial courts could be appealed to London, another sense of an external standard. So all this begins to merge into, in many ways, what is the roots of modern American constitutionalism.
And it was that idea, especially, that you don't lose your rights as an Englishman simply by moving across the Atlantic, which caused so much difficulty later on, didn't it?
Boy, did it ever. fast forward to 1765. The French and Indian War, as we called it in this country, the Seven Years' War, as they called it in Europe, came to an end. Great Britain was victorious. They had hammered their opponents. They had enlarged their empire. They were moving into places like India and around the world. Expensive business. That war cost a lot of money. And some of that money had been spent to defend the American frontier against the French and against their allies among Indians. And Parliament said, well, we defended these folks over in America. They ought to help us pay the bills.
In fact, it was really almost a Pyrrhic victory, wasn't it? I mean, because at the end of the Seven Years' War, Britain was bankrupt.
That's right.
I mean, great, you know, we've just kicked the French out. In fact, we're moving some of them down to New Orleans. We're getting rid of them, but we've got no money. We've got nothing at all. So they were really desperate for money.
Exactly. So they needed money. Isn't it interesting in this whole story from King John in the 13th century to James I in the 17th century to Parliament in the time of George III in the 18th century, there's a recurring theme that the crown or the government needs money and other people don't want to give it to them.
Well, you know, the funny thing is about that, and I'm glad you mentioned that, there are many ways to define money, but I think my favorite definition is that it's simply distilled power. That's really all it is. And that's what, in some sense, all government is about power. So it's natural that everybody's worried about me. When you take my money, you take away my power to get the stuff I want or the services that I need. Everyone is concerned about money, and quite appropriately so. It's not just greed. It's a natural concern about the division of power.
The connection between money and power is most obvious in the 1760s. When Parliament was casting about for ways to raise money, they said, well, we'll let the Americans pay part of the bills. And so they passed the Stamp Act, the famous Stamp Act. That was the first time that Parliament had endeavored to impose an internal tax in the colonies. Now, they had customs duties and all that sort of thing. That was traditional. But this was a tax to be imposed within the colonies, and they said, you can't do that. They said, it is unconstitutional. You are obliged to consult us. No taxation without representation was, of course, the famous cry. Well, the English didn't know what to make of that argument. This is the age of Blackstone. I mean, Blackstone has said Parliament is supreme. It can do what it likes. What is this? What are these Americans saying? You can't tax us.
Right.
What do you mean? We're Parliament.
So no taxation without representation. The great rallying cry of the American Revolution was because Britain was trying to impose the first internal tax, the Stamp Act, and specifically to do so to pay for the French and Indian War. Is that
that's exactly right. And the British had a kind of neat theory. They called it virtual representation. They said, look, don't sweat it, colonists. You really are represented here in a virtual sense. We look out for your interests.
Well, representation. In other words, Sonny, let me pat you on the head and take care of you and don't worry about anything.
You can call it paternalism. Don't worry, we're looking out for you. Well, the colonists didn't believe that. So the Stamp Act was the first of a series of measures as the government in London simply said, who are these people? They're doing well. They're prospering under the protection of the British flag. They have our fleet. They have our armies. And now they're telling us we can't tax them. Get real. So they began to lean on the colonists. It finally led, the famous Boston Tea Party took place.
Right. But before we get to that point where the people are really, you know, starting to get violent, there were some proposals to give actual representation in Parliament to the American colonies, weren't there? Did that go anywhere?
Never got very far. I mean, there were members of Parliament who sympathized with the Americans.
Burke, for example,
William Pitt. It was one of the most famous. That's why so many places in America name for Chatham or Pitt or whatever.
Pittsburgh.
Because of William Pitt. But
the colonies themselves, a lot of them really didn't want that representation, did they?
I think they were, what they really wanted was to run their own affairs. I think that's right.
Really? They just didn't want the taxes. I mean, I've always, you know, I don't mean to sound disloyal or like a loyalist at that time, but that no taxation without representation thing, I've always just kind of truncated it. What they really wanted was no taxation.
No taxation.
And when the ideas were discussed, well, why don't we give, you know, some, you know, American colonies representation there, they knew they would get outvoted.
Well, exactly. I mean, what would a handful of members be able to do?
They wouldn't have been able to stop the taxes, but it would have completely undercut that marvelous phrase, no taxation without representation.
They would have been given seats in a hideously malapportioned parliament. There were what they call the rotten boroughs. There were places in England that had two members of parliament, but no people.
Right.
and most of those members of parliament were in the pockets of and on the payroll of important landowners and the like. So, I mean, it made modern gerrymandering look positively benign.
Right.
By comparison. But it was the extreme form of gerrymandering and malapportionment. So that was not where the...
No, and the root of all of this also, I think, was more... I mean, we talked about the importance of taxes, the importance of power. That's certainly a big issue. But I think there was also something else going on here. And I think that the people in the colonies just were really irritated at the way they were being treated. And I'm reminded of the story of George Washington. He started out in the French and Indian War applying for a commission in the British Army.
Right.
And he was said, no, you can't have one. The best you can hope for is to be in the militia. Mm-hmm. So he joins the militia. He distinguishes himself by losing battles and things, but he's very brave, comes home with his horse shot out from under him, all that sort of good stuff, or with the holes in his coat and all of that, and he makes his name. But then he's given some lands on the Ohio River, which is the western frontier then, by the king for as a reward for his service. And then the king takes them away with a line of demarcation. And then I think even actually gave them to some of his cronies later on. So George Washington and others of his class felt that they were being disrespected by the British. And I think that really rankled them.
Probably did. And it's interesting how much loyalty persisted right up into the 1770s. I mean, the Stamp Act came and went, things quieted down a bit. And in the early 70s, I would say maybe as late as 1774, there was a good deal of warm feeling to the crown and to the mother country. I don't think Americans were bound to and set and determined to have a revolution. I think that flowed out of it. But the policymakers, Lord North and his government in Britain, were pretty maladroit. They managed to force the issue in a way which exacerbated the discontent on the American side. For example, after the Boston Tea Party, you had the closing of the port of Boston, the imposition of British troops. They were being quartered in private residences. The Americans called the acts the intolerable or obnoxious acts and the like. And then the other colonies rallied to the support of Massachusetts. Patrick Henry, famously, in his Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech at St. John's Church in Richmond, was saying, you know, they're forging our chains on the plains of Boston. Listen to them. They're, you know, look.
It's a great phrase.
It's a great phrase. And what flowed from that was a kind of consultation among the colonies. They had within each colony, there were committees of, and the like. But then there were these committees of correspondence among the colonies, which led finally to the Continental Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So the British measures that were objectionable to everybody, whatever the reasons for the American objections were, they were real enough. And they began to, for the first time, to think like Americans. I mean, I think people began to call themselves Americans about this time. That hadn't happened before. So in this burst of opposition to British policy, they began to organize, to think collectively. And then, of course, you get Lexington, Concord, finally the Declaration of Independence. Now, I'm intrigued, and this may be my lawyer's training, by how the case for the Americans was put in constitutional terms. When you read the petitions, the pamphlets, the resolutions, which poured out from every colony, from everybody's pen, they typically, they want to say, we're mad and we're going to get out of here. They make a case that sounds to a lawyer like a constitutional case. They'll say, look at that language in the colonial charters, liberties, franchises, and immunities. Look at the language of Magna Carta, part of our birthright. And then they add in, this is an American contribution, with these British sources, then they mix in a dose of natural law or the word of God. They begin to think in theological terms that God has given us as human beings certain basic, we call them human rights today. They call them natural rights in the 18th century. So they say, our arguments are based on the colonial charters, on the British Constitution, and on natural law or the word of God. So it's an interesting way of mixing different ways of thinking about an issue and collapsing them into one package. I mean, it's as if Americans were saying, look, you can put whatever label you like on it. Call it Magna Carta, call it colonial charters, call it natural law. It all adds up to the same thing. We have rights which you, the British, are not respecting.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a wonderful interview with Professor A.E. Dick Howard of the University of Virginia all about Magna Carta. But as you were just hearing, Magna Carta is something that has run through all of American constitutionalism, and many of the concepts were the sort of things that people were complaining about or demanding the right to back when we had our revolution. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Dick Howard. So stick around. Well, I'm looking at something unusual on the studio counter here between us. This is an edible product. I don't know if I should reveal what it is or whether that would be too revelatory of the quiz that we're about to have.
No, it's California raisins.
Oh, okay. Well, then you've revealed it. Okay, that's cool.
I heard it through the grapevine.
I'm so pleased that you did. Now, the big question is, do I get to eat any of these?
You're welcome to have a California. They are organic.
Organic.
Yeah, I can't mention the place I got them because they're probably not underwriting the show.
Oh, of course. But if they do give us lots of money, then we would mention them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. Do you have? Well, hold on a second. Do we have a contestant?
Yes.
Well, who are you, Ms. Contestant?
Stephanie from Bluefield, West Virginia.
Bluefield, West Virginia. I have driven through Bluefield, West Virginia on numerous things. In fact, I drove through Bluefield, West Virginia yesterday.
It's beautiful.
It is a beautiful place. Did you go to Bluefield College?
I did not. I went to Concord University.
I know all about Concord University. What a lovely place there in West Virginia. It is and has that wonderful carillon. In the bell tower, and it's just in a beautiful mountainous setting. Yeah, well, good for you. Tremendous. Go Concord. What's your mascot there?
The mountain lions.
Go mountain lions. Roar. Roar. Okay, tremendous. Doug, do you have a tough quiz question for our volunteer today, Stephanie?
I do, Stephanie. Hey, Stephanie, do you like raisins?
I do.
Me too. A lot of them come from California. Have you ever heard that song, the California Raisin song? I heard it through the grapevine.
Oh, no.
Okay. Yeah, I could do that.
Well, fortunately, I'm not going to ask you about that.
Okay.
In the most recent Supreme Court case, Horn v. Department of Agriculture, what part of the U.S. Constitution is being used to protect the California raisins?
Oh, my.
In the most recent Supreme Court case, Horn v. Department of Agriculture, what part of the U.S. Constitution is being used to protect the California raisins? Is it A, the Fifth Amendment, takings clause?
Mm-hmm.
B, the First Amendment, around the use of psychedelic raisins in religious ceremonies? C, the preamble, because we the people is discriminatory against dancing raisins? Or D, Article 2, because the executive branch should be the one developing the farm bill every 7 years.
Oh.
Well, when you say protecting the California raisins, do you mean the commercial with the California raisins? Are we talking like intellectual property here? Or are you actually talking protecting the raisin crop?
It's all about Horn v. Department of Agriculture. So it's a court case. It's just been seen by the Supreme Court.
So you're talking about agricultural raisins, broadly
defined. Agricultural raisins. Particularly, this is a farmer,
uh-huh.
The Horn family in California.
Okay.
And they took a case to the Supreme Court dealing with raisins.
Okay.
And I'm wondering whether it's A, a Fifth Amendment issue, B, a First Amendment issue around religious ceremony, because we all know the raisins are psychedelic.
Mm.
C, the preamble, right? Because the we the people leaves out the we the raisins. Or D, Article 2. Because the executive branch is the one who has to develop the farm bill every 7 years.
Stephanie, I'm clueless on this one. I cannot give you any help at all.
no. Well, I'm pretty clueless as well, but I'll guess, I suppose.
Okay.
I'm just going to guess D.
D, which is Article 2, because the executive has to originate the farm bill?
Yeah.
Now, why are you picking that? I'm just curious.
Well, I don't know. It was the only one that sounded good to me.
Okay, I'm really not dropping hints, and I'm not trying to talk you out of anything, because I honestly don't know the answer to this question, because I've never heard of the Horn case.
You've never heard of the Horn
case? I've never heard of the Horn.
Crucial case. The Raisin case. It's just been before the Supreme Court.
I'm sure it was, but for some reason, it's just not been on my radar.
This is a farmer. This is a family who's raising raisins in California, and the government is coming in and doing something that shouldn't be doing.
I'm not questioning the importance of this case. I'm simply saying I have not particularly heard of it or been following it. Therefore, Kurt, the only other one that I was thinking that might be relevant here is the takings clause. That
takings
was
clause.
An A, right? Yeah. Because, of course, the preamble, that's a little silly. And what was the other one?
The psychedelic, religious ceremony.
Psychedelic, I've eaten a lot of raisins, and they've never given me hallucinations. Mm. So I'm thinking it either has to be A or D, and you've picked D.
Yeah.
And so you don't want the takings clause. Okay, that's
Okay, well, Stephanie, I'm afraid you're wrong.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Fifth Amendment, the takings clause.
The takings clause was the one that was relevant.
Okay. It's a fascinating thing where the U.S. Department of Agriculture is actually trying to control the prices of raisins. This goes back to World War II.
Oh, I've heard of this. Yes, I've heard of this case. Yes.
And so what happens is you can't essentially take property without just compensation. And so the question is that real property or could that include crops?
Yes.
What's happened is that these farmers, their crops are actually taken literally by the U.S. government as part of this policy to control the price of raisins. And the prices that they're giving, the just compensation is quite unjust. What they're being given is below what it takes to actually raise the raisins themselves.
Okay.
And so finally a family, the Horn family in California, has taken that to the Supreme Court. We don't know how the Supreme Court's going to rule, but based on some of the comments during the proceedings, I think the farmers are going to do okay.
They may very well. And of course, finally, the bell that should have rung when you mentioned this to begin with rang in my mind. That's exactly right. We've got lots and lots of agricultural regulations, most of which seem to be left over from the Great Depression when we were trying to control farm prices to help farmers stay on their property. But a number of those subsidies have long outlasted the Great Depression and are still controversial to this day. And they typically involve controlling the supply of a crop one way or the other. And in this particular case, they actually come in and more or less just seize the raisins.
Absolutely. And to Stephanie's credit, she recognized that commodity pricing happens in the Farm Bill as well. This particular case has nothing to do with the Farm Bill.
Right.
But the Farm Bill, that every seven-year mammoth bill that comes before the legislative branch, not the executive branch, but what comes out of the legislative branch is largely about commodity pricing as well as nutrition supports.
Right. Well, that was the second best answer, Steph.
It was. It was a good one.
It really was. And so don't feel too bad. And, of course, you will get a constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. And so thanks for playing.
All right. Thank you.
And thank you, Doug.
Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the article.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the middle of a discussion with Professor A.E. Dick Howard all about Magna Carta and its significance in American constitutional law. Indeed, it was quite significant during the American Revolution when fundamentally what many of the American colonists were insisting upon was something they called their rights as Englishmen, rights that were guaranteed to them starting with the Magna Carta. Many of the concepts in Magna Carta and subsequent aspects of the British Constitution, such as the English Bill of Rights, made their way into our founding constitutional documents, including one you may have heard of called the Virginia Declaration of Rights.
And it's kind of helps you understand why American constitutional law today is so messy. Mm-hmm. Because from the very beginning, we were able to mix these ways of thinking about a legal issue, about a fundamental right, to advance and to support an argument.
Well, you know, Dick, it really strikes me that the American Revolution was, to a great extent, a lawyer's revolution.
Yeah.
It was all based on law. I mean, all those petitions, all of that stuff going back and forth across the Atlantic, I mean, it's straight out of Magna Carta and that entire tradition. So again, I think we're showing how very important that was to our founders. One that really exemplifies this late transition is Benjamin Franklin. and I'm sure you've been over to Benjamin Franklin House in London. We did a whole episode devoted to that. What was really striking to me when I went there is he spent almost 16 years directly prior to the American Revolution mm-hmm. in London, largely trying to patch things up. And then, of course, there was that whole brouhaha with the Thomas Hutchinson affair and the letters that went back and forth, and he was put on trial, basically, and eventually just concluded late, I think as late as 1774, that, you know, we just really can't patch things up. So he got in a ship, came back, and when he got off in Philadelphia, he was a revolutionary.
Yep. I mean, in a curious sense, I think you could say that many of the leaders of the American Revolution were reluctant revolutionaries. I mean, they weren't Well, some of them were firebrands, Samuel Adams, for example, in Boston,
right.
people like that. But, I mean, this was not Paris in 1789. I mean, this was not a gang of outright revolutionaries who were going to pull down the Ancien Regime, destroy it, smash it, and start something brand new. Right to the eve of revolution, American leaders and colonists were arguing for the rights of Englishmen. They said, right. we want you to respect these rights that we brought with us, these rights we've inherited. They're part of our patrimony. They descended to us from one generation to the next, and we insist on having them. And that was true, as I say, right to the mid-1770s. Then when you get the break with England, of course, then Americans begin to build new institutions. But they're building them on English foundations, not surprisingly. That's the kind of law they had. That was their constitutional vision.
So we have a revolution. One of the first things we do is start drafting our new state constitutions.
Exactly.
And they start incorporating these ideas into specific documents, many of which, like the original Virginia Constitution, begin with a Declaration of Rights. And so all these Magna Carta ideas, rule of law, are being put into these documents in all the 13 original colonies.
The early state constitutions are an often neglected part of the story because people are perfectly aware of what happened in Philadelphia in 1787. But that's more than a decade after the Revolution
right.
began. And the first thing that Americans did in breaking with Great Britain, they insisted that they should have their own constitutions.
Right.
Started in Virginia, May of 1776. George Mason, James Madison, all the others who were gathered there, they instructed their delegates in the Continental Congress to introduce the Resolution for Independence, which July the 4th, we all know about
right.
that. And the same day that they passed that set of instructions, they set to work on the first Virginia Constitution. And what I find striking is they actually started to work on two documents, not one.
Oh, do tell.
And the first of those was the Declaration of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you set down what our fundamental rights are, and you get that on paper. So today that's Article 1 of the Virginia Constitution. So
right.
you just assume it's organic part of the whole Constitution. But in 1776, it was a two-step process. First, you declare your rights, which they did. Virginia Declaration of Rights is probably one of the most historic constitutional documents ever written, very influential. So they declare their rights. Then they set to work, second step, on a frame of government. The institutions of government, the executive, legislative, judicial, all that sort of thing.
Before we leave the Declaration of Rights, a copy of which is on my office wall, which I got at George Mason's house. Shout out to George Mason,
uh-huh.
one of the most neglected and overlooked of our founders. And he was the guy who did that.
He was the guy. It is largely the work of George Mason of Fairfax County, who had learned a lot of law. He was not a lawyer. He was a planter.
Right.
But he, as a young man, he had access to his uncle's law library. He read voraciously. So before the Revolution, George Mason was already up to speed on British constitutionalism. He knew about Magna Carta and the Petition of Right and the English Bill of Rights. He knew about all those things. And so he brought them together in writing the Virginia Declaration of Rights. Now, there you have a neat merger of the natural law tradition and the English constitutional law legacy. The first three or four sections of the Virginia Declaration of Rights are pure John Locke.
Mm-hmm.
They come right out of the social compact. They basically say when people come together to form a compact, they bring with them inalienable rights, natural rights. They pre-exist government.
Right.
Then you move on through the Declaration of Rights. Then you're on English territory because you see all these rights that clearly are due process, for example, rights like that clearly flow back to Magna Carta. other rights like cruel and unusual punishment flow back to the English Bill of Rights, but it's a compendium. It's a summary, if you like, of natural rights plus English constitutional principles. That's all George Mason's contribution, and that Declaration of Rights was the model for the other states, Pennsylvania, Delaware, the others who wrote Bills of Rights. It was the model for the French Declaration of Rights of Man and the Citizen in 1789. You can lay the Virginia Declaration and the French Declaration side by side and see the consanguinity. You can see the similarities between those documents. Condorcet, the great French theorist, once said that mankind owes a debt of gratitude to George Mason, the Virginians, for writing this Declaration of Rights.
And so, now it drives me crazy. When you say George Mason, people instantly think basketball. And that's fine. That's a wonderful team. Great, right? Fine university. Absolutely. That's where we have the We the People competition every year. It's a great place. Love it. But George Mason, the man.
He deserves a lot of
credit.
Exactly. Well, I think
I was at Gunston Hall, they told me that it was his fault to a great extent because he never, ever wanted public office. He was a classic behind-the-scenes guy. He would go, he would work, he'd get this stuff done, he'd say, okay, now I'm going back to my house.
He didn't like public life.
He
enjoyed his family, his plantation, private life. He also, as things moved along, when the federal constitution was proposed, he became an anti-federalist. So in the sense of history, it looks like he's on the losing side.
Right, and he wouldn't even sign the constitution. He did it to himself, basically. Exactly. He could have been famous, but he didn't want to be.
If he had done nothing but write the Declaration of Rights of Virginia, he would have been entitled to a significant place in world history, not just American history. So you get in Williamsburg the first Declaration of Rights, the first state constitution. Interesting problem, though. Jefferson wasn't there. And I've always had a theory that Jefferson didn't like things that people did without him. That he couldn't imagine you could do it without him. But he was a critic of that first Constitution. He said it was fatally flawed because it was adopted by the same body that was making ordinary laws. This convention was passing ordinances, raising money.
He was a part of the first Virginia Constitution.
He was opposed to the first Virginia
Constitution. Okay, good. Just wanted to be clear on that.
We're talking 1776.
Because it was the House of Burgesses.
Because it was the former House of Burgesses, now
the
Virginia,
General Assembly.
Virginia Convention. And he said, this is a lawmaking body. Lawmakers make laws, not constitutions. If they make this constitution, it's just another law, they can repeal it or amend it as they please. Mm. You have to put it on a footing superior to ordinary law. That Virginia had not done. There the credit goes to Massachusetts. In 1779, the so-called General Court or the legislature in Massachusetts tried to write a constitution. People in the western part of the state wouldn't have it. They said, wait a minute. They, like Jefferson said, you have to have a constitution adopted by a different body from the legislature. So a convention was called. Delegates were elected to a constitutional convention, which met in Boston. Most of the work there was done by John Adams. Samuel Adams and James Bowdoin and John Adams were a committee of three. John and Bowdoin and Samuel Adams basically left the work to John. I expect Samuel Adams went off to a tavern and had a drink.
Probably did.
John was the class nerd, the workaholic. So he said, I'll be happy to do it.
So the tavern, beat up a few ex-loyalists, just hang out.
So John Adams was the chief architect of the 1780 Constitution, which then was put to the people for a vote in referendum. So Massachusetts did what Virginia had not done. They perfected the idea of the Constitutional Convention.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Dick. That Constitution is still in effect, isn't it?
Much amended.
But
it's still, organically, it's been...
They haven't gone back and simply said, we're throwing the old one out and doing a new one. So John Adams gets the kudos
He gets the credit. John Adams was not above taking a lot of credit for things he did.
He wanted more than he actually got, didn't he?
He basically said this in his autobiography years later, he says this Massachusetts Constitution was really the predicate for the federal Constitution. That's where the ideas all came from my penmanship.
Sure.
So that Constitution is a historic landmark because there you have, for the first time, the idea of a convention elected specifically to write a constitution, and then having the people approve in referendum its result. That's a real watershed, real step forward. You're now on the road to Philadelphia at that point.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a perfectly wonderful conversation with A.E. Dick Howard all about the significance of Magna Carta in American constitutional history. After the break, we'll come back and we'll finish our conversation with Dick, so stick around. And now it's time to finish our conversation with A.E. Dick Howard, all about Magna Carta.
It seems to me, not to denigrate the state constitutions themselves, they were inherently important, but in a way they were all practice for what happened in 1787.
Well, it's interesting when you think about the federal constitution that finally came about in the 1780s. In many ways, it was the result of experimentation, trying to get it, do it better in the 1770s at the state level. And it's very useful, that plus the Articles of Confederation,
sure,
which were adopted in the early 1780s, which were fundamentally flawed, but they were a step towards what finally became the road to Philadelphia.
And, of course, once again, the English tradition, Magna Carta, flows all through that. Now, we've done lots and lots of discussion about constitutional convention on this show many times, and I'll refer listeners to those other episodes if they really want to focus on that. And, in fact, Rick Beeman gave us a wonderful exposition of his book on that subject. But just specifically with regard to Magna Carta, is there anything else we need to say about the founding era and its specific influence?
I think so, because no one knows for sure all the words that were spoken at Philadelphia. I mean, there's no transcript.
Right.
We have Madison's notes, which comprise maybe about 10% of what was actually said on the floor. As far as I know, Magna Carta was never mentioned.
Right.
I can't prove that, but I'm not aware of anybody raising Magna Carta, because the Federalists argued that the Constitution was a step beyond Magna Carta. Magna Carta was a concession by the king,
right?
Whereas the Constitution was based on popular sovereignty, we the people.
Right.
And also, Magna Carta was a limit on royal power.
And we don't have any king.
And the Constitution was meant to be a limit on all the branches, all three branches. So that was doing something the English hadn't done. Well, all this was well and good as theoretical argument, but as we all know, the Federalists almost, they blundered because they rejected the motion at Philadelphia to have a Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they did that, they gave the Anti-Federalists, as they came to be called, an argument. They said, look, this crowd, they didn't give us any, they're not protecting our rights. This new federal government's going to be a monolith and going to stamp out our rights. So reluctantly, James Madison and the other Federalists said, okay, well, we get the point. Hold on. Just ratify the Constitution. We will then, at the first Congress, propose a Bill of Rights. Ratification was a close thing. Virginia ratified by 10 votes, New York by 6 votes. It could have failed.
Mm-hmm.
But the Federalists carried the day, and Madison was as good as his word in the first Congress. He winnowed all the proposed amendments down to the ones that were finally adopted as the Bill of Rights. So I think it's in the Anti-Federalist arguments and in the Bill of, adding of the Bill of Rights to the Constitution, that Magna Carta reappears,
right,
in the, alongside the Constitution itself. So at that point, you have a very interesting story of innovation on the one hand, new things, mm-hmm, tradition, the English tradition on the other.
And indeed, it's notable that the Fourth Amendment in the Bill of Rights, due process, Fifth Amendment, due process of law, right there. I mean, that's the most direct tracing you can have. And of course, just to expand a little bit on what you were saying, Madison and his supporters were saying we don't need individual rights because we are the people, we are creating this. In fact, I've got this really cool setup where I've divided up the power between the three branches and right, and kept the states as a separate check and all the rest of it. We got you covered, guys. You don't need these rights. And they said, no, we do. We do. And that's when they brought in the whole idea of this tradition of protecting ourselves, going all the way back to Magna Carta.
Madison had to be persuaded because first he said, we don't need a Bill of Rights. This is a government of limited and delegated powers.
Right.
And then he added the argument it could be dangerous to have a Bill of Rights because to enumerate some rights implies the non-existence of other rights. Well, Jefferson felt differently. I think Jefferson had a lot to do with turning Madison around, as well as the political realities.
Sure.
He better go along with the idea of a Bill of Rights. And so that's the power of the Magna Carta tradition that reemerges when that Bill of Rights was added to the Constitution. Phrases like, as you say, due process of law in the Fifth Amendment.
In the Fifth Amendment. Let's be clear. The Fifth Amendment, yes, not the Fourth. Okay, good. All righty. Okay, that's the founding era. Let's talk about what's happened in the last couple of hundred years. How is Magna Carta reared again? How has it come into play?
Well, the most powerful examples would be cases interpreting the meaning of due process of law.
Okay.
Because you had the Fifth Amendment, which bound the federal government, but early 19th century cases made it clear those amendments did not reach the states.
Right.
It wasn't until modern times that the states began to be reached by the Bill of Rights. So until the adoption of the 14th Amendment, 1868, the interpretation of due process of law was entirely to be found in state courts. There was a lot of cases involving due process provisions of state constitutions.
Right.
That's where most of the action was. And you find Magna Carta being cited over and over again for a number of propositions, for example.
Before I don't want to hear about those, but that you mentioned something notable. We mentioned the phrase due process of law twice. It's in the Fifth and it's in the 14th. And it's, I mean, obviously that's an important concept.
Well, exactly.
Very important. Okay, but please, you were about to say state
so
cases.
So you have the same phrase due process of law in all the state constitutions of that era. And so state courts had a lot of business and it dealt with a number of different kinds of problems. For example, if a legislature decided you were a trustee of a institution and they thought you weren't doing your job, they wanted to replace you with somebody else. Very concrete questions like that.
Mm-hmm.
So Magna Carta came to be associated with limits on arbitrary government, on equal, what we would today call equal protection,
right,
equality in the law, access to the courts, fair hearings, and all the propositions we would sum up under the notion of fairness, fundamental rights, and the like would be typically articulated in terms of due process of law.
Right.
So you had a huge body of due process interpretation before the 14th Amendment was adopted, and Magna Carta is cited over and over again as where it all came from. So Magna Carta became not only the origin of phrases like due process of law, it's actually used in American litigation right on through the 19th century.
Just remarkable. Okay. So it's relevant even to modern American law. And let's talk about its current relevance. I mean, does that relevance continue to the present day?
Well, I mean, that's the question. Here it is 800 years later.
Yeah.
Who cares? I mean, we've got a lot of other interesting things to talk about. Why talk about Magna Carta? Well, Magna Carta was and remains the iconic example of the rule of law, what we call the rule of law. Now, American lawyers in particular like to toss about the phrase rule of law as if it's self-explanatory. I think it's not self-revealing. I was working in Leningrad, as it then was, now St. Petersburg, with the drafters of the first post-communist Russian constitution. This was back in the days, 1990s, when we thought that Russia was going to be a liberal constitutional democracy. Mm. In the age of
Putin. Where are you, Boris Yeltsin? Yeah.
Where are you when we need you? In the age of Putin, that seemed like a long time ago.
Gee,
But I was working with these Russian lawyers and judges, and I don't speak Russian, so we're working through a translator. And I discovered, she was very good and doing a wonderful job. I discovered at one point that she was rendering the English phrase rule of law as socialist legality. I had to say,
you can tear down the wall, but you can't completely rid yourself of Soviet language.
Well, exactly, the old thinkers,
the old thinking,
the old thinking. And so I had to say, well, no, that's not exactly what we mean when we say rule of law. So Magna Carta is the ultimate icon of the idea of the rule of law. Secondly, I think it is really it's a nice place to trace the organic unfolding of the idea of fundamental rights.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of ancient rights, the baron said, we are simply insisting upon existing right. We're not lawmaking. We're affirming a tradition. Well, that's part of the American tradition even today. I think the idea of putting it in writing,
mm-hmm.
the idea that we were the first country in the world to have a written constitution. Poland was for the first in Europe, then France, and now most everybody has one. That's a Magna Carta. The notion that you have these documents, Magna Carta, Petition of Rights, English Bill of Rights, Virginia Declaration of Rights, U.S. Constitution. And I think beyond those, I think some of the modern day lessons of or legacies of Magna Carta include the whole idea of constitutional supremacy. Mm-hmm. You know, what Jefferson complained about, that the Virginia Constitution of 1776 was not fundamental law. We take it as axiomatic that if you have a constitution, it has to be superior. Well, okay, how do you make it happen? You can say it's superior. What do you do to actually bring that into play? Well,
you stick the three words, we the people, on the front. That takes care of it all,
yeah,
right?
Sure. Well, that actually, that's the way the French proceeded.
Mm-hmm.
The French idea is that you have external guarantees, namely the people are the ultimate resource.
Mm-hmm.
If government is misbehaving, if things are going badly, the people take care of it. Well, that's a nice revolutionary idea in a constitutional democracy. That's a pretty messy way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
The barons at Runnymede thought about the problem. They didn't trust King John. They didn't think he was going to keep his promises. So they provided at the end of Magna Carta for a committee of 25 barons to enforce the charter. And if the king didn't keep his promises, they could basically lay siege to his castles. Well, that's a pretty clumsy solution. That's like saying, okay, you can have a civil war. But at least they recognized the problem of enforcement. We obviously have dealt with that by way of Article 6 of the Constitution, the Supremacy Clause, which says this Constitution and all laws enacted in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land. And John Marshall, Marbury versus Madison, 1803, famous opinion, says that must mean that the Supreme Court has to treat the Constitution as superior to even to acts of Congress. Reluctantly, carefully, but still we have that not only authority, but that obligation.
And I have to interject here, and they adopted Jefferson's idea that Adams had adopted in Massachusetts. When we had the ratification process, we had state conventions.
Yeah. Yep.
We went to the people. Now, it wasn't everybody, but it was to the people in an attempt to get that broad legitimacy.
Yeah. So I think there's a road from Magna Carta right down through the centuries to and beyond the Supremacy Clause that when we deal, I mean, for example, you have Supreme Court opinions today. In the 1950s, it was Brown versus Board of Education. The White South famously invented massive resistance and tried to cripple that Supreme Court effort. Happily, it finally failed.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court insisted on having its way. You have a famous...
Citing Marbury, by the way.
Citing Marbury, of course.
And that was Cooper versus Aaron, wasn't it?
Cooper versus Aaron, the famous case coming out of Little Rock,
mm-hmm.
1958, where every justice signed the opinion, and the governor of Arkansas had tried to say, well, look, Arkansas wasn't a party to Brown versus Board. We're not bound by it. Supreme Court said, nope, wrong.
Yes, you are. Yeah.
You are bound just as everybody is bound. We call the shots. I mean, it's actually the road from judicial review to the road to judicial supremacy. The court saying we're the ultimate arbiter. So
now, before we leave that, and I realize we're going off on a little bit here, but that always seemed to me to be an overlooked episode. I mean, literally, you have President Eisenhower calling in the 101st Airborne Division, mm-hmm. nationalizing the Arkansas National Guard, and he was demonstrating what judicial supremacy requires. The court doesn't have an army.
That's right.
The only army is in the executive, and what it was required was for the court to say no. Marbury, we interpret the Constitution, and you will obey it. And then they had to look over to the White House, and Eisenhower, who was no huge champion of civil rights and who would rather focus on the Russians and other things,
mm-hmm.
I think probably somewhat reluctantly said, okay, they're right, and I am now going to enforce this. And though I don't think people actually were going to have a civil war at that moment, I think that may be the closest moment we've had to having a second civil war. You literally had the National Army facing off or potentially mm-hmm. facing off with a militia of a state.
Mm-hmm.
That's a striking moment.
And of course, we have contemporary examples of politicians, some state legislatures, who would like to stand in the way of the implementation of Supreme Court decisions. We will find out at the end of this present Supreme Court term whether same-sex marriage is a constitutionally protected right.
Roy Moore doesn't think so.
Amendment.
Chief Justice down in Alabama, he says he's going to defy it.
Exactly. The legislature of Texas is entertaining bills to instruct their officials not to go along with it.
You mentioned the Supremacy Clause. Let's recall the rest of it. And the state officials in each state, I'm paraphrasing here, take an oath to the U.S. Constitution,
right,
notwithstanding anything in the contrary to the, in the state
exactly.
constitutions or laws. It's very explicit. This is the
that's
supreme
right.
law
exactly.
of the land.
When you take an oath as governor of Virginia or the attorney general of Virginia or any other state, you take an oath to the U.S., to your state constitution.
U.S. Constitution,
but also
right.
to the U.S. Constitution. And it trumps the state. Even a state constitution
yes.
has to yield to the U.S. Constitution. So I think in an interesting way, this whole development can be traced right back to Magna Carta as
wow.
being something fundamental. When Lord Cook in the 17th century decided Dr. Bonham's case and said that that acts of the Parliament that offended right reason would be null and void. He was using Magna Carta as the basis for that. So in that sense, we don't cite Magna Carta when we cite Supremacy Clause. That Article 6 is obviously the one we look to now. But it's built on this tradition that I think flows from Magna Carta.
The ideas.
The idea.
The idea, which are very powerful. Now let's take it back from the theoretical and to the very specific. This is going to be broadcast right around June of 2015.
Good.
Where are you going to be? You going to be in Runnymede?
I will be at Runnymede on June the 15th.
Uh-huh.
I go over at the end of May.
Uh-huh.
I'll be in England for about 3 weeks. I've had...
Tough duty,
it's,
Dick.
It's
I'm sorry you have to do that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm willing to take on this burden. I mean, it's been kind of a cottage industry of invitations. I'll be speaking at the American Embassy,
uh-huh.
at the British Library, where they have two of the 1215 charters, the Bodleian Library in Oxford, which has two of the 1217 charters. I'll be speaking at Salisbury Cathedral, which has one of the 1215 charters, at a couple of Oxford colleges. I mean, I'll be making the rounds, and I will be obliged, reluctantly, you may be sure, to sit at the table with people and drink toast and eat their food and generally sort of celebrate Magna Carta with my, I'll bring myself to the point of being willing to do it. And it's all going to wind up at Runnymede on June 15th. The Queen will be there.
Cool.
Which I doubt that I'll be anywhere close to the Queen, but I've seen her twice, once in 1976 in the Rotunda at Charlottesville, the second time in 2007 when she came to Jamestown, and now at Runnymede in 2015. That's a nice trilogy.
Okay, if you do get to talk to the Queen, will you give her a message from all of us?
Of course.
Just say, look, Queen, if you just respected our rights as Englishmen, none of this would have happened.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The whole unraveling of the British Empire probably started
in
America.
That was a big screw up.
But maybe,
just let her know.
Maybe in the long run, the British are better off not having to run an entire empire.
Well, it could
simply
be.
Simply having a family of nations, as it were.
It could be. They seem to be
it's
doing
a mixed
okay.
blessing.
Say hello for us.
I'll give her your personal regard.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Dick Howard all the way over there in Runnymede right now, even as we're broadcasting. Say hello to the Queen for us, Dick. We appreciate you. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Chad Barrett and Bob Hoffman. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, which is part, in turn, of the British experiment. And that all goes back to Magna Carta.